Hi, it's Kate Brownfield from ADHDKidsCanThrive.com. Thank you for being here. Thank you for all your support. My guest today is Dr. Katya Fredrickson, a pediatric neuropsychologist and author of a new book titled Different Thinkers, ADHD. It is a comprehensive resource about ADHD for children and adults alike, offering practical advice for managing symptoms and reflection prompts designed to help readers understand what it means to be a different thinker. Dr. Rothman and Dr. Fredrickson wrote this book together in hope to help children understand their ADHD diagnosis and celebrate their different way of thinking. Please enjoy our conversation. I'm looking forward to talking to you. You and your partner, Dr. Rothman, are authors, but you're also doctors who oversee and work with children who are neurodiverse. So I'm looking forward to speaking to you today and kind of having you share your expertise with us to expand our knowledge as parents on helping our kids who struggle with ADHD.
I'd be happy to.
Okay, good. Okay, so let's start with, what is ADHD and how is it diagnosed?
So ADHD is one of the most common neurodevelopmental conditions, right? So it's something that you first see in childhood. And there are three sorts of things that you're looking for. You're looking for some combination of difficulty focusing and sustaining attention to tasks or activities that are perceived as not as stimulating to the child. You're also looking for difficulty inhibiting impulses, could be behavioral impulsivity, like sort of jumping off the high ledge, could be rushing through work. So sort of impulsivity as regards task output. And you're looking at difficulty regulating the activity level. So you're sort of your fidgeter, right? Your person who has just a really hard time sitting still in their desk. And so you're wanting to see some combination of these three characteristics. And there are specific criteria and you need this number of this and et cetera, et cetera. And so you sort of go by the book and you look at the criteria. A couple important things are, A, you need to see the things in more than one place. Right. So if the child is showing these sorts of difficulties, but it's, for example, just at home or just at school, then you have to pause and think, is there something to do with that environment as opposed to the child, him or herself? Right. So you technically, before you make a diagnosis, you want to either we're seeing it at school and or at home and or in the testing office and or at soccer practice and or at Girl Scouts. So we need to see the things in multiple environments and we need to be sure that they're going beyond what's developmentally appropriate, right? Because a lot of the things I just mentioned are at various stages of development completely typical and expected behavior. And so what we need to figure out is whether the traits in question are interfering with the child's success in some way, and are they sort of unusual for the child's age?
And what do you do if you're seeing things at home that includes homework, but the school is not really on board yet with serious flags that your child might be struggling?
Well, so
like, how does a parent navigate that?
Yeah.
Right? They're
yeah.
seeing things, but it's not necessarily translating into the school environment.
And so that's very often, or I shouldn't say very often, but that can happen with the kids who have the more inattentive type presentation, right? Which is more subtle, more common among girls in particular, more subtle, less readily evident. So this could be your student who is sort of sitting in the classroom and maybe not 100% zoned in all the time, but oftentimes quite bright and eager to do well. And so they still rub along pretty well until they hit a point where the level of demand just skyrocket, you know, in middle school, high school, where you just can't get along based on your native intelligence and your compensatory strategies. And you really need to be implementing those attention and executive functioning skills. So yeah, so it's not at all uncommon where we have parents come in and we get parents have a question. We always obtain, we speak to teachers, we get standardized questionnaire data from teachers. And it's not at all uncommon that teachers will say, oh no, you know, a little Sally is doing great and she's a model student and et cetera, et cetera. And so you just need to, that's important feedback, but also you take it with a grain of salt because you want to, okay, so in the context of a larger classroom setting with other students whose needs are perhaps more pronounced, little Sally may not show up that much. That doesn't mean there's nothing there that's getting in her way. And we just need to dig and see if we see it.
And is ADHD being overdiagnosed, especially, I think, in the culture, in America's culture, And also with the prevalence of phone use.
Well, and when we start school, right? Because some of the Scandinavian countries, for example, don't start school until kids are a little bit older. So are we having developmentally appropriate expectations? I was just literally in my office this morning evaluating a little boy who's in first grade who just turned 7. He's not able to, at this point yet in his development, meet those demands of what's being placed on him in the classroom in terms of sitting still and keeping his hands to himself and not calling out and et cetera. But does that mean he has a disorder, quote unquote? Or is that, anyway, is this sort of an interesting discussion, right? Or are we perhaps having unrealistic expectations for what he can and should be doing at that stage of development? Sorry, so I didn't...
I know, this is very typical, right? These are the things that can happen, especially with boys who are around that age.
Yeah, you have to be so cautious when you're evaluating them, because you really, on the one hand, if there is something there, you don't want to miss it because it could cause them to fall behind, because these are critical years in terms of taking in and sort of cementing the core academic skills. But on the other hand, do you want to diagnose something where the child might end up being medicated or just, you know, having a label attached to them is not in fact accurate. So you just need to be extra cautious.
Yeah. Okay. And do you think the phone is playing into this at all? For our young people?
Yeah, well, I certainly do see data suggesting that our attention spans overall are decreasing, right? As a people in general. And we do know that kids with ADHD, it's sort of a chicken and egg scenario, right? We do know it's not that the screens will create the ADHD, but might they make it sort of worse, I guess, is a question mark I have. And then we also know on the flip side of the coin that people with ADHD have a harder time regulating screen use. So, I mean, it's definitely a variable that we need to, as parents, be, you know, A, regulate, but B, also be realistic about, you know, in terms of, I tend to recommend moderation as opposed to no screens, right?
Okay, that's good advice. Okay, so then you touched a little bit about girls and why is it so difficult to diagnose girls? And what should you do if you are a parent who suspect, like, is it better to wait? Do you go until the world starts to fall apart for them?
That's a good question. Yeah, so for girls, and this is not always the case, but more often than not, we see girls present with this more this inattentive type, which is predominantly the distractibility and the inattention symptoms, which is more subtle and less readily evident to the outside observer, right? And so I think if parents have questions or if teachers proactively and supportively sort of say, hey, just FYI, you know, I've noticed this in the classroom. You might want to sort of keep an eye on that. I think it's important to, first of all, we want to watch for a little while. I think just to be sure, you know, you get one piece of feedback doesn't mean you're necessarily, you know, panicking and running off to get an evaluation, right? So maybe you sort of, okay, this is on my radar now. I'm going to sort of keep an eye on this. But then I would set a deadline because, you know, our lives are busy. And if we adopt a wait and see approach, it can end up taking a long time before we do ultimately sort of wade in there and decide to take a look at things because we're so busy with all the other demands in our lives. Yeah. So my personal advice would be to, you know, sort of, okay, this is on my agenda now. I'm going to set, you know, it's March 22nd today. So if I check in with this teacher again at the end of the school year in June and the same concerns are there, then I'm going to start looking into things over the summer. Like I'm going to just give it a couple months to see if it's a phase or some sort of, maybe the child hadn't been sleeping well. There was just maybe some other variable that was contributing to the concerns. Some social issue, who knows? And then but if we're still hearing that after a couple months, then I would want to start to think seriously about just gathering more data to try to figure out what's going on.
Okay. Okay, good. Okay, so when your child is going through the diagnosis process, not the problem, it's a process.
Right.
I think parents struggle with, like, how do they get their child on board with that progress, especially if they're younger, not like a teenager where they're younger. How does a parent go about helping their child be a part of the process without, you know, creating angst?
For sure. Well, so the fact of the matter is, I think most kids, I mean, maybe not the little itty bitty ones, but most kids as they get older, are much more aware than many adults give them credit for, right? So very often, I think kids have a sense that maybe something isn't going the way it should. Like, I am having a harder time learning the math than my neighbor here at my disc cluster, or the teacher is calling me out more often for moving around or speaking out of turn or whatever. So there's some sort of awareness that something is not quite right, and they may not know what it is. And kids, unfortunately, I mean, it's just the way our brains work, are quick to sort of make negative attributions related to it. Oh, well, I must just not be as good at math, or I'm just not as well behaved as so-and-so, or whatever it is. And those are negative self-attributions are dangerous, and something that we want is one reason why Dr. Rothman, Yael, and I wrote our book, was to help parents present proper diagnosis in a supportive and appropriate way to help kids really truly understand what's going on with how their brains are developing and why they may be having some difficulty in certain areas and what can be done to help. So, I mean, I do think it's important for kids to understand, okay, you're right, X is a little harder for you. You're right. X is a little harder, but it's not your fault. It's just sort of all brains are different and your brain has many strengths. Here's something that's a little harder. It doesn't come as naturally. And there are things we can do to help you with that. And here is what we're going to do, kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about your book, because I think that might help us as we continue our conversation. Is, why did you write this book?
Well, so
tell us about the book. So you wrote a book for children.
We did. Well, so our book is Different Thinkers ADHD, and it is, so we're making, it's going to be a little series of books about different sorts of different thinkers. And so we took on ADHD first, because it's one we just so often see in our clinical practice and in our own sort of personal lives as well. And so what we do in the book, with the help of our I think charming illustrator, who, I mean, you know, pictures make a big difference when you're visuals, when you're making, I mean, for anybody, but especially for children, right? So what we do is we present a, I would say, sort of elementary school aged explanation of how your brain develops, what the different parts are and what they do, with, again, a lot of visuals. And parents can really sort of go over this as quickly or go as in depth as they want, depending on their child's level of development and interest in the topic, right? So you can really sort of customize it and delve in or skim over sections that are not as relevant or your kids maybe not in the right place for developmentally. But so we initially present that just with the idea that here's your amazing brain, here's how it works. And guess what? It's still growing. There's still a lot of growing left to do. So we're always wanting to promote this growth mindset. In other words, this is not a fixed, you know, when you're struggling with something, try not to view it as fixed. View it as an area of growth that you can work on and improve on, just like our brains are growing and improving at that age, at least, right?
Right.
And then we present some vignettes of different, because ADHD looks so different in different people, right? And so we want to present some vignettes so that kids who have ADHD can hopefully find something they identify with, right? Because that can sometimes be something we hear. It's like, oh, well, I don't have ADHD. My cousin has ADHD and you should see him. I'm nothing like him. And you're sort of like, well, that doesn't mean you don't, you know, just different, right? So we try to present these different sorts of vignettes. And then we sort of, you know, but these kids all have something in common. They have ADHD, right? And then we go through what that means. We go through some sort of interesting facts. We go through some strengths, which is very important. We want the kids to come out understanding that having a different thinking brain is a beautiful thing. And then we go through ways that our original characters, strategies that are put in place to help them with the difficulties they're having. And then we sort of have the child think through their own strengths and areas of relative vulnerability and what are some strategies that might be useful here, some ideas, kind of thing. And there's a little workbook they can fill in at the end. So the idea is the parent or other caregiver, teacher, therapist, whoever, grandparent, reads the book with the child. And there are moments in the book where there are sort of built-in moments to pause and reflect, like, do you ever have that feeling? Has that ever happened to you? Blah, blah. So you can sort of pause and have a little conversation. And so that the reason we wrote the book was because all the time parents are asking us for resources. They are asking us for resources for their own learning and knowledge, and they're asking us for things that they can read with their children, right? And so we've tended to keep a pretty close finger on the pulse of what's available, just because people are asking us all the time, and we really want to only recommend things that we think highly of. And we just, both of us had a hard time finding books designed for this age range that really tackle the diagnosis of ADHD as a whole, as opposed to zeroing in on a particular trait, characteristic, symptom, and the book being focused on that one thing versus sort of, here is the whole thing. Here is why, what it is, why it happens, and the strengths, et cetera. So that was sort of our thought process.
Yeah, that's great. And I think personally, I think like children's books, even for adults, is an awesome way to give the adult the language that they need to be able to talk to their kid. Because parents do get stuck in, how do I explain this to my child? How do I relate to them in a way that they're going to understand and kind of stays at their level? And children's books are amazing at doing that. Even if the kid doesn't read the book, it's incredibly beneficial, I agree, to the parents.
Well, and you know what else is cool? We've had friends who have read the book with their kids who do not have ADHD, and multiple people have come back to us and said, hey, my kid said, oh, yeah, that doesn't happen to me, but that happens to so-and-so in my class. And so it helped develop a greater understanding for them of the range of neurodiversity in their in the daily sort of environment, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love that story. Okay, so we understand why you wrote the book, and just tell us a little bit more about why it's important to have your child be a part of that process, because that is the angst with parents.
Right.
How involved do we get them into their diagnoses? Mm-hmm. And at what age, and how do we include them in there?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, so many parents who come in and meet with us are alarmed by the idea of a quote unquote label and sort of what that would mean and the potential stigmatizing effects. And I understand, of course, we're all very protective of our children. And I also understand that some parents are coming at it from a perspective where perhaps back in our day when they were kids, they may have had a difficulty or a diagnosis or something that was perhaps, you know, just based on the fact that things weren't always, you know, the 80s wasn't always the kindest place to grow up. I mean, things weren't always handled the way we handle them these days. There wasn't the same degree of knowledge and just acceptance, I think, that we have much more so these days. So, yeah, so a lot of parents come with alarm related to that. But again, we tend to feel like most kids, they are aware that something is not quite right. And we would much rather they had the appropriate understanding of what it is, as opposed to something is wrong with me. I'd much rather they understood, oh, okay, so I have an ADHD brain, and that means that I'm good at XYZ, and ABC is a little harder for me. And here, and mom and dad and my teacher and whoever else, my doctor, my pediatrician, whatever, they know what to do to help me. And here are strategies that work for me. And then they can even go and self-advocate, you know, like, gosh, it really helps me, new teacher next year. It really helps me, new teacher, when I have like a written copy of the instructions, not just hearing you say that. So they just learn these things. And I think it adds a sense of empowerment that's so important for self-esteem.
Yeah, especially as I get older, right? Mm-hmm. It does not. Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely great. So that they can take on kind of their own advocacy as they go into high school and college or whatever they do as adults, right?
They have
a better handle on it.
Yeah. Initially, we want parents to be the squeaky wheel, to be asking questions and trying to learn as much as they can from teachers. And then as kids move on, we want them to start being their own squeaky wheel, so to speak, in terms of speaking up for their own needs.
Yeah. And have you found in your practice when kids do learn how to self-advocate, it helps? It's to their benefit?
I certainly think so. I mean, you know, out in this world, we can't always guarantee that everyone who we speak to is going to have the best understanding about what we're speaking about. Which is a number of extra prepositions there, which made that, I think, a little bit garbled. But so, I mean, I can't promise that every person who your kid goes out and speaks to will be like, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I wholly understand, because they're going to talk to people who may not have a modern, updated understanding of certain things. But we can prepare them to do that. We can prepare them to, we can role play, we can coach, we can, you know, there are all kinds of things we can do to prepare them. Because, I mean, the worst case scenario I see is more that they don't say anything and that they end up suffering in a way that they don't need to when there was a potential solution that they were scared to communicate, right?
Yeah. Yep. Okay. And then your book also highlights that there are strengths that come with having ADHD. It's not all negative. There are positives to that. So explain to us, like, from your point of view, you know, as a doctor, like, why is it important for parents and teachers and the community to focus on the strengths that these children have?
Well, I just think that, again, human beings, we have a negative bias. It's like it's just how our brains are wired. It's an evolutionary thing that tries to protect us, right? So, you know, you hear a story about the Boeing planes having an issue or whatever, and you think, oh my God, I'm never going to fly again. Right? It's a protective mechanism. But we have to be aware that so often it comes with a negative perspective. And kids with ADHD, there is research showing that, which should not be surprising, but there's research showing that they just get a lot more negative feedback than kids who do not have ADHD. There's a lot of the stop doing that, don't do that, sit down, don't touch, blah, 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 or much more so, right? And the preponderance of that negative feedback over time, no matter how well-intentioned the person is who gives the feedback, right, the cumulative effect of that can have a negative impact on the child's self-esteem and their sense of their sort of competency. And so, it's important to be aware of trying to balance our feedback more tilted toward the positive than the negative, catching them being good and doing things well and offering appreciations for the good little things they do during the course of the day. And it's important to remember that there's a can't do versus a won't do with respect to many things, where most children, it's if they're not doing what they need to be doing, it's probably because they're not ready yet, as opposed to they're like literally choosing not to do it in order to be oppositional.
Right.
And so with that perspective comes the idea, A, I want to skew more positive. B, I want to come at this from an understanding of where my child is developmentally and what they are and are not yet capable of. And C, I want to recognize the strengths that come along with this. And so there's research showing that people with ADHD are more creative, they're more spontaneous, they're more energetic, there's more out-of-the-box thinking. So artists, inventors, CEOs, I mean, there are plenty of people now who are talking about their diagnosis of ADHD. Again, much less stigma these days than there was in the past. A lot of people talking about it who have really cool jobs and careers. And I think so, a lot of great role models out there.
Okay, so as we wrap up, what would be your words of wisdom for parents who are either in the beginning stage or even any stage, really? It's a lifelong journey, right? Being a parent of ADHD children, what would be your advice for them just to carry them forward?
I guess a couple of things. One would be it can be really tiring, right? Parenting in general, and then parenting a child who has any sort of special need or any sort of difference or any sort of just anything that makes life a little bit harder for our child. Because, you know, the saying, you're only as happy as your unhappiest child, right? Yeah. So it can be really hard for a parent. And I would just encourage everybody to just remember to take care of themselves. It's the whole thing with the air mask thing on the airplane, you know, put on your own mask first. Yeah. It's so important, because if we are unhappy, anxious, unbalanced, distressed, kids just, they're like little sponges and they'll pick up on those things. So for our children's well-being, but also for our own well-being, because we are the captain of the ship, right? And so we need to really just do what we can to support ourselves, get dinner every now and then, go out and have dinner with friends, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's so important. And not always as hard as we fear it will be. You know, the dreaded, oh, this baby won't be able to handle my kid. Well, guess what? Maybe they will. And maybe the kid will watch TV for 2 hours while you're gone. And who cares? Maybe that doesn't matter, because you got out and you did the things you needed to do. Right. So I would just try not to let yourself be held back by your fears. And then I always just come back to that can't do, won't do. I mean, because the minute we sort of think, oh, gosh, maybe this kid is actually not able to do this yet versus this kid is purposefully pushing my buttons and not doing what they're supposed to do. It's a whole shift in our perspective in terms of the patience and kindness we can bring to bear in that situation.
Yeah, that's great advice. And society will feel like it's against you on those markers sometimes.
Sure,
right. Sure. But I think your advice of just, you know, looking at them for where they're at versus kind of what the culture is saying where they need to be at. That's the balance, right? The rub, right?
Be kind to them and be kind to yourself, I guess, is the main idea of those two thoughts.
Yeah.
This is great. Thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it.